This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we learn more about police infiltration of the social media accounts of immigrants, activists, and others. This comes at a time when police departments across the nation are under scrutiny for illegal practices.
We're joined by our guest, Susan Riverby, whose book, Co-Conspirator for Justice, The Revolutionary Life of Dr. Alan Berkman, has just come out. It's totally relevant to what's going on now, and we're very pleased to have Susan Riverby on the show.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. In late 2016, a trove of emails revealed that law enforcement had been monitoring the social media accounts of Black Lives Matter protesters. One police sergeant in Memphis, Tennessee, even opened a fake Facebook account to impersonate a Black activist, infiltrate Black protest spacers, and gather intelligence on hundreds of others. In Minnesota, an FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force used a confidential informant with access to private social media communications about a Black Lives Matter protest and fed that information to local authorities. It turns out that such tracking is routine practice among local and federal police agencies. They use it in criminal investigations and to keep tabs on lawful First Amendment-protected activities of dissent. And as we've seen so often in other areas of surveillance, police monitoring persons online usually impacts historically over-policed communities. It also has a chilling effect on free speech and all online communications. The Brennan Center in New York has issued a comprehensive report on social media monitoring by police. It shows how personal information gleaned from social media posts is used either to target dissent or to subject religious and ethnic minorities to increased vetting and surveillance. Joining us to talk about this form of surveillance is Harsha Panduranga. Harsha is counsel at the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program. His work has been featured in numerous press outlets, including The Atlantic, Slate, The Daily Beast, and Just Security. Harsha, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be here, Heidi. Thanks for having me.
Harsha, this year the Department of Homeland Security has rapidly expanded its collection of social media information to assess security risks posed by travelers. But DHS has not been transparent about this initiative. What does the Brennan Center know about it?
Yeah, that's a great question. There was a big requirement that was rolled out by the State Department about a year ago that proposed to collect social media handles on all visa forms, or nearly all visa forms, so from about 15 million people a year. After these handles are collected, they say that they're going to be used for vetting purposes, but in reality, the State Department, along with DHS, claims the authority to store them, retain them, share them potentially with foreign governments, and use them for a wide range of purposes. We also have an existing proposal by the Department of Homeland Security that it could collect social media handles on its own forms, including petitions to become a citizen for asylum applications and a number of other causes. But basically what we're seeing is a broad, unaccountable collection of social media, which hasn't really been shown to work for the purposes of, you know, quote-unquote, determining whether someone's a security threat.
And just as we've seen with NSA surveillance, the DHS program vacuums up information about Americans, their friends, their family members, even business associates in the process of ostensibly targeting just foreigners. Talk about the groups that are the most vulnerable to this kind of surveillance.
For context, we have an ongoing lawsuit against the State Department and Department of Homeland Security challenging the State Department's collection of these handles and the State Department and DHS's subsequent retention of them. But I think that from the perspective of who's likely, most likely to be impacted, It is people that are in groups that have historically been discriminated against, as well as folks that speak, you know, different languages or from different cultures. And there's a couple of reasons for that. The first one has more to do with the operational aspects or how social media analysis itself works. You've got an American officer who might not be as steeped in the customs or traditions of a range of different communities. They might not put remarks or things that they read in social media in their appropriate context, and so that can fail to catch things like humor and sarcasm. And I think that anyone that has maybe not been familiar with a particular Twitter meme or joke and then sees it recirculated can kind of relate to how a lack of context can really harm your ability to interpret something properly. There's also increasing use, or at least there have been tests of automated tools, which themselves don't end up fixing the problem. When you're talking about natural language analysis tools, which basically attempt to, you know, decipher the meaning of social media, it's found that in many cases, you know, they disproportionately fail to interpret basically slangs that are more commonly used by communities that are historically discriminated against at a much higher frequency. But that's just on the operational side. In terms of who's being targeted, I think it's definitely not a stretch to say that the Department of Homeland Security, as well as whoever is using social media surveillance, whether it's the local, you know, local police force or, you know, anyone else, you know, doesn't have a great track record when it comes to keeping an eye on where the real threat is. A real good example is the FBI's category of black identity extremists, which has been released in a number of documents and kind of came to the fore after the Ferguson protests in 2014, even though there's no, you know, absolutely no evidence that such an organized movement exists, let alone one that's deadly. You know, there's evidence that the federal government hasn't paid adequate attention to white supremacist violence, even though recent events have clearly shown that that's a very serious and deadly problem.
We know, of course, that when individuals are aware they're being monitored, they change the tenor of their communications. Let's talk more about surveilling protesters. In addition to tracking social media posts, we've heard about fake police accounts on Facebook and other places, for example, and instances of infiltration and even impersonating activists. Have you seen that?
There's actually a pretty infamous, famous example from Memphis, Tennessee, of a police sergeant creating essentially a false Facebook account to impersonate a black activist and infiltrate online protest spaces and kind of collect intelligence on hundreds of folks protesting essentially racial injustice. Obviously, when, you know, law enforcement is watching, and in particular, if you're from a community that's been historically targeted by law enforcement, that is going to kind of make you think twice before you exercise your constitutionally protected right to advocate for social change. So yes, there are instances of that happening, and obviously it's concerning for that reason from the perspective of stifling political dissent.
And Harsha, we're not just talking about one time or short bursts of monitoring. Police stay with one person or one group for extended periods of time. Much like protracted surveillance, it has a kind of stalker-like quality to it, doesn't it?
Yes. It's interesting, too, and, you know, I have heard kind of in the sphere and anecdotally that a sort of interesting intersection is between the policy considerations connected to the coronavirus and the monitoring of legitimate political dissent. This is sort of a newer development, but certainly the spread of the virus raises concerns that people who aren't necessarily tasked with public health enforcement, like law enforcement, for example, are going to be looking to the epidemic as a pretext to figure out, you know, who's coming from what neighborhood to protest where. So that's certainly a newer overlay. It's not a one-off thing. I think in many circumstances you have seen a sort of a consistent effort by, you know, the relevant law enforcement agency to monitor the movements of protesters. Another example that I can think of is that it came out, I believe, at the beginning of last year that the Department of Homeland Security was monitoring a number of activists and lawyers and even social media influencers that had been traveling across the border to do, you know, was it essentially humanitarian work or bringing attention to the issues surrounding the quote-unquote migrant caravan, or basically migrants from Central and South America that were looking to come to the United States. And it turned out that the DHS had been maintaining a kind of dossier of these people's photographs, their passport information, their social media data, you know, in a way that obviously suggested that it wasn't something that someone decided to do a search one time. It was sort of a more comprehensive and coordinated effort.
You raise an important point. I assume that this data assembled in different databases is all correlated, so that, for example, if a fusion center is interested in a particular person or organization, they have access to it.
Yes, in the lawsuit, which obviously has a narrower focus than anything that's done by local police departments, it does address the fact, the information sharing component, because one way to look at it is the quote-unquote information sharing or dissemination component, meaning defining that as once the handles are collected, the government claims the broad authority to kind of retain them in some cases for 100 years after a person's birth, and then also share them for a range of really broadly defined purposes that include language like to enforce quote-unquote other laws of the United States, which I think can mean literally anything. The problem is that it's not only, you know, if you are participating on social media and you're doing activism that could put you to harm in your home country, or you're worried about saying something that an officer could interpret, it's not just that you're going to apply for a visa or you're going to be cognizant of that in your limited, you know, immediate interaction with the government. You never know when it could come back and bite you in the future, especially if your information is being kept around for, you know, an indefinite period of time. So one way to look at the peril of the retention is just that it increases the scope and increases the burdens associated with preventing you from speaking or the chilling effect on your speech.
In New York City, we've had several RICO-based prosecutions of teenagers living in Bronx public housing projects where many people knew each other in the community. Police were monitoring their social media and swept up over 100 teenagers in one instance who had no involvement in gangs. What is your take on misinterpreting how teenagers talk online?
On the misinterpretation question in particular, there's no doubt that concern has, you know, a special salience in the context of children or younger people, just because often they are at the cutting edge of kind of developing slang and, you know, often purposefully talking in ways that people can't really understand. I would say that one way to look at social media monitoring of children and social media monitoring in schools is it's a way of putting a counterterrorism oriented approach into a school context, meaning that you're basically casting a very broad net for quote-unquote threats and treating everyone with suspicion, when in reality, the school is more of a place where, you know, it should be treated as sort of like a part of social policy, a place where kids can learn, and other values other than law enforcement and threat and suspicion or climate of threat and suspicion are what's being fostered. So I think that if you look actually at a lot of criticisms that are being made of police or that have been made of police for a long time but are really coming to the fore, I think that approaching dealing with issues that kids might have from like sort of a threat-focused lens causes a lot of problems, including the ones that we've, you know, pointed out with regard to social media monitoring in this context.
After the Brennan Center and other groups raise awareness of such monitoring, I understand that Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter tweak their platform policies to forbid company data being used for surveillance by police agencies. And as a result of this change, the center reported a tapering of purchases by law enforcement agencies of social media monitoring software used for threat detection. But that's got to be still going on. Is the slowdown in mass collection?
You know, I actually can't speak to that particular trend or particular representation, but what I can say is that Twitter and Reddit have filed amicus briefs in support of our lawsuit against the State Department and the Department of Homeland Security. But in terms of their sort of brief and position focused on the importance of anonymous speech and the fact that some of the requirements that the State Department has would actually require you to turn over handles that you used anonymously to prevent you from government or third-party retribution, and how that was, you know, contrary to actually some of the values and practices that happened at the founding, where a lot of people that, you know, engaged in debates surrounding the Constitution and independence actually used anonymity to protect themselves. That is a position that they had pointed out. But with respect to their cooperation with law enforcement or lack thereof, I can't speak in detail to it.
Harsha, I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier, namely that the DHS data collection on travelers has not resulted in any significant successes that we've heard about.
In fact, quite the opposite. The Department of Homeland Security, you know, kind of in the build-up to the State Department implementing the kind of bigger collection from 15 million people, I think, about a year ago, they had done a number of tests to determine whether social media review was, in fact, a good way to identify security or public safety threats. And they actually found out that a lot of the issues they ran into are issues that we had been pointing out for a long time, which is, for example, internal emails between people at DHS showed that, you know, it was hard to verify the reliability or credibility of things that were said on social media. It was hard to understand what people were saying without further context. So kind of coming at it from, we don't know if this is really contributing to, you know, us being able to do our jobs better. There was also an independent audit, meaning an audit by the Inspector General of DHS that was done in 2017, or whose results were released in 2017, that basically found that DHS hadn't put in place sufficient metrics to evaluate whether its, you know, programs were useful or not, and therefore that the existing programs, the pilot social media vetting programs that it was running, couldn't be useful sort of platform for scaling the practice. So one way to think about it is, you know, the government didn't do its homework, or to the extent that it did do its homework in determining whether it was useful for the purpose that was intended, it certainly didn't find that was the case.
In your opinion, what level of weight should be given to this kind of information, say, in court proceedings?
Well, I think that it certainly should not be stripped of context. Obviously, you know, things like testimony from actual people and evidence that can be tested kind of in a meaningful way in court is much more powerful. But I think even stepping back from the aspect of, you know, any sort of evidentiary value that social media information might have, I think it's, you know, it's really important that surveillance that's conducted by police departments or, you know, federal agencies that serve as the predicate for investigations or otherwise used to further them, that needs to be done pursuant to a set of kind of defined rules and policies that take into account, you know, people's constitutional rights, that at least serve as a check against, or at least, you know, serve to confirm that certain kinds of groups of people aren't being targeted, like we would do with any other sort of initiative when we're talking about a society that's governed by the rule of law. Actually, to that end, the Brennan Center and a number of other advocates in New York City have been working to push what's called the Public Oversight of Surveillance Technology Act, the POST Act, in the New York City Council to get the NYPD to disclose certain information about the surveillance technologies it uses and do a number of impact and efficacy assessments on them and that kind of thing. So that's expected to come out for a vote tomorrow. And so to the extent that your listeners are in New York, I would encourage them to call their council members and urge their support for the POST Act.
Harsha, if you don't mind sharing, how did you come to be affiliated with the Brennan Center and to pursue this line of work?
I've always been very interested in constitutional law, in particular the doctrines of equal protection. I used to work at a law firm leading up to, I guess, 2016 and early 2017, and understanding that, of course, a lot of these problems that we face are, weren't started by the Trump administration. The election of the president was certainly something that got me motivated to work on try to do my part to help protect the rule of law and people that might be targeted by sort of discriminatory policies.
How can our listeners learn more about your work and follow you on social media, as it were?
Go to BrennanCenter.org, and obviously the organization, I work in our Liberty and National Security program, so that focuses on sort of rule of law and civil liberties and civil rights in a public safety / national security policy space. Some of my colleagues work on voting rights and working on redistricting reform and campaign finance issues and a host of other things. But I'd encourage you to check out the website, and you can follow me on Twitter at harshwords222.
Harsha Pandurama, thank you so much for joining us today.
I really appreciate you having me. Thanks for having me on.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Battling recurrent cancer for half his life, Dr. Alan Berkman died in a New York City hospital on June 5th, 11 years ago. Alan was first struck by cancer when he was in jail, accused and then convicted for his political work in the underground. He was a leader of the small May 19th movement, an offshoot of the Weather Underground. They did symbolic bombings of political targets to protest American imperial atrocities and did armed robberies, which they called expropriations, to support themselves. No one was ever hurt in their activities. After Alan served 8 years in some of the worst prisons in America, four of them in solitary, his cancer came back, but the authorities stalled on giving him adequate medical care. They hated him for being a socialist, a Jew, a doctor, and a supporter of blacks, Latinos, and American Indians. Alan had been active in the anti-Vietnam War movement. He'd been a practicing doctor for 10 years in New York's poor communities. He was forced underground for years because he wouldn't give up the name of the woman he treated for a gunshot wound she got in a failed Brinks armored truck robbery that killed two police officers and a security guard in Rockland County, just north of New York City. After 8 years in prison, amazingly, attorney Ron Kuby, an associate of Bill Kunstler's, prevented New York State from taking away his medical license. Alan started working as an AIDS doctor in the South Bronx. In a year, he became the head of the program. At that time, at the height of the AIDS epidemic, Alan helped form HealthGap with the help of ACT UP and Housing Works. They fought Big Pharma, which controlled manufacturing and distribution of the antiviral AIDS cocktail. a combination of medicines which cost $10,000 to $15,000 a year, an exorbitant price guaranteed to them by their ownership of medical patents, their intellectual property. People could not afford the drug, and thousands died. Dr. Alan Berkman helped change that, not having the requisite respect for private property. He got sick people drugs that were produced generically and brought the cost of the drug down to $87 a year. Some 4 million people in the global South took the medicine, prolonging or saving their lives. His biography, Co-Conspirator for Justice, The Revolutionary Life of Dr. Alan Berkman, has just been published. It was written by our guest, Susan Reverby. She's the Marion Butler McLean Professor Emerita in the History of Ideas and Professor Emerita of Women's and Gender Studies at Wellesley College. She's the author of Examining Tuskegee, the Infamous Syphilis Study and Its Legacy. Susan Reverby, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, Michael.
You know, I was also good friends with Alan Berkman from the time he got out of prison until 2009 when he died. You knew him in high school, where he was voted the boy most likely to succeed. And you knew him in college, where he played football and was the president of his fraternity. You both were from a small town, Middleton, New York, and you both grew up in a Jewish community there. What was it, do you think, that gave Alan his values?
His family, mostly, I think. He came from a family that really believed in taking action. There was a family story about a grandfather who had evidently killed a Cossack in Eastern Europe, which is one of the reasons their family left for America. So they were tough. His parents owned a plumbing supply company. So he comes from not from a professional family, but from a working class family. And we grew up in this small, white, primarily white, working class town with very few Jews. So I think it was both the family's physicality, its commitment to Israel and to Jewish cultural values. It was a reminder that we were all the first generation after the Holocaust, and we grew up in the 50s really believing in all of the things we were being taught in school about America and its promise.
Was this a tough book for you to write?
It was awful, actually, and I've written a number of books that were hard, but this was the hardest, in part because I knew the ending, right, from the very beginning, because he had died. And also because it really is, for a lot of people of my generation who became political, the path not taken. So here was someone who I knew as a child. You know, I met him, I think, in junior high school, actually. And here was someone who grew up like me, went to college like me, in the same place, and then made a series of choices that probably ended his life earlier than it might otherwise have been. So it was emotionally exhausting, frankly, to write it.
Unlike you, who were active in the anti-Vietnam War movement at Cornell, your classmate Alan was not. What got him active?
It's so interesting. I mean, that's the part that I find fascinating. I mean, he went to a couple of anti-war demonstrations, but he really was on his way to his brilliant career. I mean, he was really an incredibly smart person, as one of our classmates said. We were all smart, but Alan was really, really smart. And he, but when he was a senior in college and president of his fraternity, mind you, Stokely Carmichael from the Black Panthers came and spoke at Cornell, and he really did talk about white supremacy and racism, and it seems to have really gotten to Alan at some point. So I'd say by the end of his senior, he was sort of prepped to really think hard about these issues. And then he got to medical school at Columbia in 1967. So then, within rapid succession, the huge struggle at Columbia happens in 1968, and he's part of the medical students who provide medical care for the students who had taken over the buildings at Columbia, and he saw the police being completely violent toward peaceful demonstrators. The Panther 21 trial happened in New York during the time, and one of the 21 was a biochemist who was also at Columbia. He started to make friends with people who were in Weather and then in the Weather Underground. So by the time he finishes medical school, he's really made this big leap that, you know, people started to make in college, which he did not. But then he makes it during medical school.
he practiced community medicine when he graduated in the underserved parts of New York City for 10 years. And then he was active in various small political groups. Susan, tell us about these groups and what they tried to accomplish and how they attempted to do it.
He was first in a group called Prairie Fire, which was an outgrowth of Weather, even though he had some political differences with them. And I think he was one of the people who helped write their major manifesto. And then there was a split, and he was part of a very small group, probably in between 100 and 200 people, in something called the May 19th Communist Organization, which was named after the birthday of Ho Chi Minh and Malcolm X, which gives you a sense of what their politics were. That is, they were both interested in anti-colonial and anti-imperialist struggles and in anti-racism struggles as white people to try to think, given what's going on now, it's worth thinking about what it meant to be white and to be involved in those kinds of support struggles. He was in the leadership of an out branch of May 19th called the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee, which helped educate people about the presence of the Klan, particularly in New York State prisons, but also about issues of white supremacy. So he was extremely connected to anti-colonial struggles and to anti-racism struggles for probably at least 10 or 15 years at that point.
Tell us about how they attempted to accomplish their goals.
Well, mostly they were trying to do a lot of education. So they had a library, they did lots of postering, they tried to educate people in the community. But a small group of them were also providing essentially, you almost want to call them the women's auxiliary, because it was mostly the women in his organization, and the leadership was primarily women, who provided support for something called the Black Liberation Army. So this was an offshoot, or sometimes formed around the same time as the Black Panthers, who were really concerned with using armed struggle, particularly against police, to accomplish anti-racist goals. So one of the things the Black Liberation Army people in New York did was to free a sister revolutionary named Asada Shakur from her prison in New Jersey and to get her essentially to Cuba, where she in fact still lives. So the Black Liberation Army people were trying to raise, every revolution needs money, right? You have to support your fellow revolutionaries. And so they were doing what they called expropriations, what the police would call robberies. And one of them was against a Brinks truck in Nanuet, New York, just outside of New York City in October of 1981. And a number of the people in Allen's group provided the getaway cars. They drove the getaway cars, and the robbery expropriation went terribly awry. And two policemen and a Brinks guard were killed, and a number of them were caught by would-be expropriators were caught by the police. And one of the women who was doing the driving accidentally shot herself in the car. And so Allen, who knew nothing about this ahead of time, was then called to provide the medical care to basically save her life, which he does, even though, you know, he didn't approve of the action, but there was a comrade who was shot and he couldn't take her to an emergency room because the question would then be, of course, who she was, and they would have identified her through her fingerprints. So he takes care of her, he saves her life, he helps whisk her into the underground, and that's when the federal government really goes after him as accessory to murder after the fact, even though what he committed was essentially a misdemeanor, that is, refusing to report a gunshot wound.
Well, they went after him the same way that the doctor, Samuel Mudd, who treated John Wilkes Booth, the assassin of Abraham Lincoln. Allen then became the second doctor to be targeted by the police. But let's talk about Allen then goes underground, that is to say, he disappeared from public view. What activities did he pursue when he went underground?
Right. So after the government goes after him, twice actually, he spent 7 months in jail for refusing to speak to the grand jury, mostly because he wasn't going to name names and tell them anything about who was involved. He was sure that he would be facing an enormously long prison term. So he and a group of other people in his organization go underground, and they make it clear that they want to make it clear to the United States government that it's going to be expensive politically to keep up with the racism and the imperialism. So they start bombing, and they do, they're very clear about this. They do non-lethal bombings. They check the site. They're really careful, although they're actually quite lucky that nobody accidentally walked by. And they did 7 or 8 bombings of places like an FBI office in Staten Island, an antechamber in the U.S. Senate, the Navy Yard. And the government, of course, is going after them but can't find them, at least at first. But as the FBI says, we can wait them out and they'll make a mistake. And so small mistakes were made. And eventually, within 2.5 years, everybody in the group was caught, including Alan.
We're talking with Susan Riverby, who wrote an outstanding biography of Dr. Alan Berkman. Susan, what's the name of your book?
Co-Conspirator for Justice, The Revolutionary Life of Dr. Alan Berkman.
After several years, Alan was caught and he was tried. He was labeled a terrorist. How did he and his comrades view themselves?
They said over and over they were not terrorists. They were very clear that they had never killed anybody, that they didn't use the weaponry that they had against other human beings, but they were trying to make a political statement. So they saw themselves as resistors to the U.S. government. And in fact, the major trial, Alan actually in the end had 3 different major trials, and the last one, he and his comrades were put together in a kind of conspiracy case, and so they labeled themselves resistors, and they called it the resistance conspiracy trial.
One of the things that I didn't know about when I read the book was that when Alan was in jail in Philadelphia, he met and became friends with Mumia Abu-Jamal. Talk to us about that, please.
They seem to have really just clicked. I mean, Mumia actually gave a statement that was read in Alan's memorial service, and I wrote to him as well, and he told me that what he saw in Alan was a comrade whose righteous anger was being used to become an anti-racist and to really be a principled person. And Alan saw in Mumia also a strong comrade, and he wrote to one of his friends and said how horrified he was that here was this beautiful man with this unbelievably mellifluous voice and long, long dreads who was going to be fried in the electric chair, and it completely horrified him. So I think they saw the strength in each other, and it's around this time that Alan gets his moniker for prison, and he's called Brother Doc, and that's what Mumia called him.
Alan was tried and convicted and sentenced to 10 years in prison. What was the trial like?
Well, he had, as I said, he had 3 trials, and the first one is actually where he scored luckily. He had a relatively sympathetic judge in the first case, and he at one point actually, and the evidence was kind of, you know, circumstantial around what they were blaming him on, but in any event, he was convicted and given 10 years, but the judge actually kept following him all the years he was in prison and kept tabs on what was happening to him. And in the second trial, he was given a, because during the time he was underground, he and another man in the group had actually done a robbery to gain some money. And so this was a robbery trial because he had accidentally left his fingerprints behind. And that judge gave him a concurrent sentence, which was, you know, just, and then he was serving that one on the same time as the 10 years. And then the final case, the resistance conspiracy case, is fascinating because at that point, Alan was having his second round of cancer, really seriously sick in prison, and he almost died. And his comrades agreed finally that they would end the case and plead guilty to some of the charges so that they could save Alan's life and save him from having to go through the last trial. It was an unbelievable act of comradeship and solidarity that saved him.
What kind of medical treatment did he get when he was in prison?
Well, Alan has a very great sentence, which would make a great slogan. He said there's a real difference between prison health and prisoner's health. And so what you get is prison health, which was unbelievably terrible. When Alan was at Marion Prison in Illinois, he literally was the only doctor in the prison who had a license. The guy who was the prison doctor had never been licensed. He'd gone to medical school, but he never passed any of the state exams. When Alan was in first discovered that he had what he thought was Hodgkin's lymphoma because he found the lymph node that was inflamed. The doctor didn't even know how to examine him, and Alan had to guide his hand to show him. And there are numerous cases throughout Alan's treatment during those two bouts of cancer in prison where if he had not been a physician, he definitely would have died because he knew exactly what was happening to him. And the most dramatic story is he's in a prison hospital bed. He can hear people outside, and he realizes he's about to be in septic shock, and he's going to die. He can't move anything but his neck, and he keeps yelling, and no one comes in. So finally, he moves his neck enough to get the IV line, the intravenous line, between his neck and his shoulder, and he pushes on it, which sets off an alarm when the IV doesn't work. And then the nurse came in, and he said, "I'm in septic shock. I'm going to die." Had he not known that, he would have been dead in a few minutes.
We're speaking with Susan Reverby, who wrote a terrific book. Susan, please remind us again the title of your book. It's available now. It just came out a couple weeks ago. Tell us what it's called, please.
It's called Co-Conspirator for Justice, The Revolutionary Life of Dr. Alan Berkman.
Let's bring this conversation about Alan's activities up to date, Susan. I wanted to ask you about the strategy and tactics of May 19, and did Alan rethink these while he was in prison? Critics then and now of those tactics of symbolic bombing, what the May 19th people called propaganda of the deed, pointed out that it was counterproductive, that it put the onus of violence on the movement instead of on the government where it belongs. And the worst of it all was that it kept the masses of people on the sidelines. Even if they approved of it, they were sidelined and uninvolved in their own liberation. Did Alan come to any reconsiderations?
One of the ways he survived the prison experience, especially because he was in solitary a lot, is that he wrote to a lot of his friends and his comrades. And in a lot of those letters, which made it possible to write the book because he got them back from the friends he sent them to, and so they've been preserved. And in it, he's starting to really think about what he had done and what they had accomplished. And as I said in the book, I think the best way to describe him is that he was very good at being a revolutionary, but not very good at leading a revolution. I think they just didn't look around them and realize that people were not coming along with them and not sharing the actions that they were taking. And I think Alan really, by the end of the prison time, had decided two things. One is that he wanted to make what he had survived in prison and what he had learned through the prison experience and his cancer experiences mean something as he went forward in his life. And secondly, that he was not going to be involved in very small group politics where everything becomes so intense and all of your commitments become very tied to a small number of people. So I think it's at that point that he rethinks the turn toward violence and the things he had done, even though he was always committed to not killing anybody.
Alan was a revolutionary in reactionary times. Lenin observed that sometimes nothing happens for decades, and other times decades happen in a week. Can you imagine what Alan would have thought about what's going on now?
Everybody who knew him as an adult really misses him now because they think he would have had a kind of brilliant analysis and a sort of organizational sense of what we might be doing. So I think one of the things we have to consider is, you know, we talk a lot about the work that's been done in the last 5 or 6 years by Black Lives Matter, but I really think you have to go back and think about the extent to which people doing what's called critical resistance, who have been fighting for abolition of police and of prisoners and of prisons, have been doing a lot of this work for decades now, and I think it's coming to fruition. So we can be grateful that there are now videos that we can actually see what's going on in real time, but it's these years and years of political work that I think underlies what's happening now.
Susan, let's talk now about what Alan did when he got out of prison. When he got out, Ron Kuby, who was Bill Kunstler's associate, managed to save his medical license. What kind of work did Alan start out doing then?
So he got incredibly lucky. That is, most people who get out of prison have a very difficult time getting work. But Alan was still a white man with a doctor's license. So he starts working first in Harlem Hospital as a in an education program for physician assistants. Then he becomes a doc in a program for for ex-prisoners. And then finally, he spends about 10 years at a place called Highbridge, Woodycrest, which essentially was an HIV-AIDS kind of nursing home program at the time when HIV-AIDS was a death sentence in the Bronx, one of the outer boroughs of New York. And he does that for 10 years, setting up really terrific programs for people and being absolutely clear that people who had been homeless, drug addicted, coming out of the prison system, be treated with the kinds of dignity he did not get in prison himself.
He then began an association with two South African doctors, revolutionaries, who were in New York City at Columbia. Please talk about them and how Alan got involved at Columbia.
So these two amazing human beings, Mervyn Susser, who has now passed, and Zena Stein, who is still alive, were white supporters of the ANC in South Africa, had to flee for their political work in the 50s, go first to London and then end up at Columbia. And Alan's wife, also a physician named Barbara Zeller, meets Zena Stein at an international AIDS conference and mentions Alan. Zena knew who he was and what had happened to him. And to make a very kind of complicated story, they have a son named Ezra Susser, who is also working at Columbia, and Alan gets introduced to Ezra, who immediately realizes how smart he is, even though he has absolutely no idea how to do research or to do any real global medical work. Remember, at that point, he's working in this little nursing home right in the Bronx, and he has no, you know, he dropped out after his internship. He has no research experience, but Susser takes him on. And Alan is an incredible quick study. He gets involved in doing AIDS work at Columbia and learns the skills of epidemiology and how to do research. And so increasingly and eventually the people at Columbia were able to actually get him a job at Columbia to teach global health and to be involved in their AIDS program. And Irvin Susser had a great line, Ezra Susser had a great line about Alan, which I just love, which when they tried to hire him at Columbia, it was a little difficult, right? He drops after his internship. He has no publications other than, you know, pamphlets and, you know, leaflets, right? So it's not exactly what you get when you're trying to get hired by an Ivy League school. But then they worked in South Africa, and Alan had the perfect credentials for South Africa because he'd been a political prisoner of the United States. Everybody understood that, right? So he was immediately believed, and he was quite useful. So you never know where your skills will be. It's a great story.
It's really funny, Susan.
It is.
At that time, antiviral medicines to treat AIDS patients in the epidemic were very, very expensive, I think $10,000 to $15,000 a year. And Alan helped form and lead an organization called HealthGap. What did they accomplish?
So Alan was really, really aware of the problem that he would go to these international conferences on AIDS once he could leave the country and he was off parole, and they would call the conference Bridging the Gap. But in fact, they didn't bridge the gap between of AIDS patients in the international world. And so Alan really, really, really fought very hard to get antiretrovirals into the Global South, and he was very involved in trying to make sure that they could be generically priced so that they could use generic drugs. And so the organization really fought U.S. trade policy and really got it to change. And so he said at the end of his life, the thing that he was the most proud of was the work he did with HealthGap.
Do you have a favorite passage from your book that you could share with us?
Yeah, I thought I would just read a paragraph from the end because of thinking about Alan's relevance to what we're doing now. So here's the paragraph. Not many of us will ever have Alan's particular blend of personal conviction, willingness to take risk, loving and principled support, an ability to suspend fears in order to make commitments. Alan showed extraordinary physical toughness in the face of suffering and married his intellectualism to practicality. Most of us who shared his critique of American society and politics did not join the groups and actions Alan was willing to work in. We turned away, fearful, self-protective, more aware of the government's power. Above all, we did not think this was the way to the revolution. Others were critical of the armed groups' growing sectarianism and threats of violence. They did not share these groups' views of how to move forward and could not condone their actions. Even Alan would admit that what they had tried had not worked. That's it.
We've been speaking with Susan Riverby, who just wrote Co-Conspirator for Justice, The Revolutionary Life of Dr. Alan Berkman. Susan, unfortunately, we're coming to an end of our allotted time, but before I let you go, I wanted to ask you if you would just talk a little bit about Alan's comrade and companion, Barbara Zeller, and what she did along with Alan to do this great work.
He could not have accomplished or survived, I think, without the support that Barbara provided for him throughout his life. And she was a physician they met in medical school, and she was in with him throughout his entire life. She supported him. She did political actions around him. She was in May 19th with him. And there's just in his last letter, when he knew he might not survive the treatment for his final cancer, which is true, he has this beautiful line at the end, and he says, "And to Barbara, it always was a love story."
Susan Riverby, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. You've written this wonderful book. I urge all of our listeners to get it. It's called Co-Conspirator for Justice, The Revolutionary Life of Dr. Alan Berkman. It's just come out, and it really is a monument to a section of the movement for social change. So courageous, so committed. It's something that I think everybody should aspire to, even if the tactics they choose prove to be incorrect. It's part of our heritage, and you've managed to capture that, Susan Riverby, and I thank you very much for your hard work. It must have taken you some 7 or 8 years to write this book. It's a great book, and I urge everybody to get it. And thank you, Susan, for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael, for the opportunity to meet your audience. I appreciate it.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.